Welcome to the NutraCast, a production by Nutra Ingredients USA. I'm Danielle Masterson. Thank you for joining me here on the NutraCast, where we talk and share insights from inside the nutrition industry.
When it comes to starting a dietary supplement brand from scratch, there is a lot to consider. Suppliers, contract manufacturers, regulations, supply chain, the list is never ending. So where do you start? Well, today we're going to speak with someone who works with startups and has seen it all. Joining me now is Brian Yam, VP of Regulatory Affairs and Quality Assurance at Blue Ocean Regulatory. Hi, Brian, and welcome to the NutraCast.
Hey, Daniel. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you on. So before we get into everything, why don't you tell me a little bit about your background and how you ended up where you are today?
Sure. So, it feels like only a minute, but it's definitely longer than that. It's been since 2004, 2005. I've been in the industry on the manufacturing side, specializing in regulatory affairs, working within the contract manufacturing side of things in Canada, and kind of started my, career in that field, and then moved over to validation, really understood what life was like on the production floor, validating methods, equipment, processes. And then as the company expanded into like international markets, international meaning, US, Australia, Japan, Taiwan, and others, that's when they brought me back into regulatory affairs and just climbed that corporate ladder. Did 14 years in that particular organization and thought, you know what, it'd be nice to move over to the brand side. And that's when I transitioned over to, the brand owner side and really understood how operations and regulatory compliance works from there. One of the brands I worked with was Vega, and they're like one of the pioneers in the vegan plant protein spaces. And they were acquired by White Way Foods and Danone. So I've been working with them and building out their supply chain, working with all their contract manufacturers, sat on the leadership team with Vega, as well as the quality leadership team at Danone North America. And then from there, decided to transition over to consulting and kind of dabbled into that world. And of course, as we all know, COVID hit, and classic cliche family, we moved over to the East Coast here in Canada and started my company here, Blue Ocean Regulatory. And this is where we're helping the startup brands. And when we say startup, what does that mean? It could be that entrepreneur, that the brand, spanking new person that's got that great light bulb aha moment idea, to the sub $50 million in total annual sales. And we're helping these startup brands navigate FDA and FTC and grow their brand altogether. And, when you look at these two demographics, they have, very unique challenges, right? The entrepreneur, they're going to have, budgeting constraints. They're going to be incredibly green to the whole dietary supplement world. And from what I've seen, they're going to be vulnerable to making some operational mistakes, but also be vulnerable to being taken advantage of by manufacturers or ingredient suppliers or just the operational side of the supplement world. Whereas on the established startup side of things, they have obviously more funds with them, but now they're at that stage where they're probably going to take a little bit less risk. They want to incorporate more compliance into their operation, but they still have that entrepreneurial spirit. And I think where we separate ourselves from other consulting firms is we're not afraid to honor that entrepreneurial spirit. And sometimes that means, me taking off that compliance hat just for a moment and seeing things from that perspective, from their entrepreneurial perspective, and kind of making recommendations from both sides, both the compliance and the entrepreneurial side. So here we are. We've got a YouTube channel. We're dabbling into LinkedIn and trying to crack those two algorithms. So that's been a lot of fun. And really excited to be here and to discuss more about this.
Brian, it sounds like you've done everything but work on the assembly line. When it comes to starting a supplement brand from scratch, what is the first step that a company should take?
A couple things. I think the first one is just having a very tangible idea of what your formula should be, or even better, like what should your supplement facts look like? Or even better, like what should your packaging look like? What claims are imperative for your brand or for your product? And really the goal here is to have something that you can give a contract manufacturer to quote on. And you really want to have a strong, detailed idea of what the end product is going to be so that the whole quoting exercise, the relationship establishment, is just going to be much easier. And the contract manufacturer is really going to appreciate that rather than giving them this fluffy concept, this idea of, hey, I'm just gonna be here to disrupt the market, but you formulate, you do all this upfront work. The manufacturer doesn't want to do that. They just want to make the product, ideally. I mean, if you're an established brand that's in the CPG space for a while, sure, they'll provide additional services to build out your formula, but they would rather you do all that upfront work. So that's number one. Number two is, I would say, you know, for the entrepreneurs out there that are new to the supplement space, like, really build out that knowledge of the supplement industry and the operations. Ideally, the goal here is to keep up with manufacturers, you know, during those meetings. And, you know, when they talk about how the industry works, when they talk about, look, we've run into this testing issue, we've run through this supply chain issue, or there's, you know, test method variability that's inherent in the method itself, that you can keep up with that. I know there's a lot in that, but just having a good foundation or basic understanding, I think, is something that they would definitely appreciate. And to that point, if, you know, if there's anyone listening to this podcast right now, definitely check out our YouTube videos. We have a lot of content geared to the entrepreneur, the person that's just starting out, that has this idea and they're thinking about building a supplement brand. And then lastly, something to factor in is, you know, just know which platforms do you want to sell on. Like, do you want to go on Amazon? Do you want to go on TikTok? Maybe you want to go brick and mortar, or like on iHerb.com. And it's really important to know those conditions that particular platform has, and to factor that into the conversation with your manufacturer. I think a lot of the times we're so gung-ho about starting the brand or the company, we just think about, I just need to get product. But then we forget about these other requirements that a platform might need to have or requires above and beyond FDA or FTC. And so it's really important for us to kind of just get a sense of, like, what are their requirements, and build that into the conversation with the manufacturers right away, so that there's no surprises down the road.
Yeah. One of the first things I always ask new brands is, did you have any idea what went into starting a brand? And the answer is always no. And they always have a whole new appreciation for the dietary supplement industry.
It's crazy. It is the Wild West to a certain degree. And there's just so many, what they say, unknown unknowns. Unfortunately, I also think that there are, you know, a lot of those unknown unknowns are very well known. It's just hard to get that information, or it's, you know, it's difficult to know the truths from the non-truths. But yeah, it's a wild industry. I love it for that reason, by the way.
And so what common mistakes and challenges do you often see with startups?
Yeah, that's, gosh, there's a lot. You know, I think the first one here is, a lot of the times, like I said earlier, you don't know what you don't know, right? And manufacturers are counting on this. Not all of them. I think there's a lot of good manufacturers out there, but there's also a lot of shady manufacturers out there. And the manufacturers that are shady are counting on you not knowing how the industry works. And so it's really hard to tell, you know, if a manufacturer is saying something that's legitimate, or are they just giving you the runaround? And a lot of the times, startups just don't understand the complexities and the regulatory nuances of the dietary supplement space. So it's really important that you arm yourself with the right resources to help you navigate through this. I had one client, they were working with a manufacturer. I'm going to say that in quotes, because after further discussions with them, they ended up being a broker. They just disguised themselves as a manufacturer.
Oh, wow.
And they were telling the client, look, we don't do testing. We don't test our products because FDA doesn't allow us to test products, because it would be a conflict of interest if we tested our own products. Like, that was the reason. And they wanted the client to do their own testing on the side. And, wow. And you know, as we probe this even further, obviously, we knew that they were lying. They even mentioned, like, oh, Amazon is the most difficult platform to get your supplements in there. We serve the Amazon brand space. If we can get into Amazon, we get you anywhere. And the client, they don't know what they don't know. So do you listen to them? Are they saying the right thing? Now, you and I both know, and your listeners know, obviously, they're given, you know, they're not saying the truth. But, you know, for the startups, that's kind of where there are some gaps there that they're trying to figure out. The other thing, too, I think, from common mistakes, this is this idea of looking for investment too early, or expanding into, like, distribution or retail too early. I think that could definitely hurt a startup brand. If it's just too soon, obviously you want to have a lot of control over your company. You want to have a lot of say of what kind of branding, you know, what your brand looks like, what you guys stand for, what claims are made on there. But when you have a lot of investors, a lot of people all in the kitchen. I think that complicates things. And then lastly is read the fine print, read the terms and conditions between the startup and the manufacturer. Look at their return policy, look at their responsibility in terms of label claims, like who's responsible for the label claims. Most of the time, it's the brand owners. In the fine print, they say right there in writing, you as the brand owner is responsible for the labels. Yet at the same time, the sales exec might say, oh, we have our own regulatory department. We're going to make sure your labels are completely fine. And the truth is that the regulatory department is just making sure that there's no disease claims. But there's, as you and I both know, there are so many other claims that can be made that could still put a company at risk, you know, all natural, 100% organic, all these other claims you could be liable for that they're not looking at, right? They don't have that full on expertise sometimes, but at the end of the day, in the terms and conditions, it says that the brand owner is responsible, and they always point to that when there's an issue. So it's important that we do ask for the terms and conditions, read the fine print, and maybe negotiate what those terms are once you see what you're liable for versus what they're liable for.
Okay. A lot to consider, and it sounds like read the fine print and just don't take their word for it.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, that's the case. I mean, I do get clients say, Brian, why do we have to keep doing this? Why do we have to check in? Like, and you know, there's a part where I agree with them. Like, they shouldn't have to do that. My job shouldn't exist. You know, the quality role, you know, philosophically shouldn't exist if everyone just did the right thing and followed the rules. The reality is that's just not the case. And FDA has said it many times, and so have several others, experts in this space, so you trust but verify. We have to go in and make sure that they're doing what they say they do. One common example that comes to mind a lot is, you know, when a client or an established brand is looking for a new manufacturer. And I'm using them as an example. I don't mean to beat up manufacturers at all. It's just top of mind right now. You know, when a brand is looking for a manufacturer, right, like this idea of trust but verify. So when you're talking to a manufacturer, you'll ask them, what kind of testing do you have in place? And they'll say, oh, we do GMP compliant testing. We test for ID, we test for potency, we test for heavy metals. We do X, Y, and Z. So then what happens is there's an assumption, right? We make the assumption that they're going to do that same exercise for my product, for the brand owner's product. And unfortunately, that's not always the case. Sure, they can do X, Y, Z, but the question is, are they going to do X, Y, Z for you? And that's where a lot of startups also miss. And they don't have that conversation to clarify if XYZ is actually done for the product. So there are many times when a supplement brand realizes later down the road, oh, they're actually not testing my product for potency. Oh, they're not testing my products for heavy metals or other contaminants. They're doing everything, you know, the quantifying by input, where they're just theoretically calculating what the label claims could be, but they're not actually sending it to a lab. And so we're making the assumption, I think that is the unfortunate case, which is why we go back to this trust but verify approach. We do have to check in, especially in that early stages when we don't know the manufacturer. We want to build in the right expectations. We want to build that relationship. And I think that's the best way to do it in this space. You know, unfortunately, it's a little more hands-on than we'd like, but it's also the reality.
Mm-hmm. How do you see the current regulatory environment in the context of ingredient innovation?
Yeah, gosh, this is a big topic. You know, I think, you know, we do need to ensure that, you know, ingredients are safe and, you know, those that are permitted for use in dietary supplements actually end up in dietary supplements. This idea of new dietary ingredient notifications or ingredients having GRAS status, it does address this concept. You know, ultimately, we don't want pharmaceutical active ingredients in our supplements, nor, like, I'm going to make up an example like this, uber novel, like nanonized isolate, you know, that could cross the blood-brain barrier. We don't want that. We want to have safety. I mean, common sense dictates that we want to protect our consumers from ingredients that can be harmful. But I think, you know, where things, at least for me, falter a bit is the mechanism that's in place. And if we look at the case of the new dietary ingredient notifications and the expectation from FDA, and bear in mind, I do have to look into this further. I know that they released the guidance fairly recently, the updated one, some clarifications on that. It sounds like that the expectation is that for every product that uses a new dietary ingredient, that product, like every product needs to have a new dietary ingredient notification. And to me, I just feel like the friction is too high. Like, if that is the expectation. So, for example, if I have a dietary supplement, I want to put activated charcoal in there. And let's just say activated charcoal technically falls under the new dietary ingredient notification. So now the expectation is that dietary supplement one needs a new dietary ingredient notification because it's activated charcoal at 10 milligrams. And then dietary supplement product number two, if there's 50 milligrams of activated charcoal, that needs to have a new dietary ingredient notification as well. It's a lot. I get it. I mean, if FDA's point of view, at least my assumption is that, at 50 milligrams versus 10 milligrams or 20 milligrams, the interactions might be different with the ingredients. It's a different safety profile, like, and they're trying to account for that. But there's a behavioral component that I think that is missing here. And, when there's too much friction for a brand to submit an NDIN for every product, I don't think they're going to do it. And I don't know what the answer is here, but a part of me feels like maybe we could look to the music industry a little bit. Back in the day, people were downloading music off the internet for free, but then when Apple came along with iTunes and 99 cents per song, it was just the right amount of friction. Sure, 99 cents, no problem. iTunes, no problem. Just hit the download button. Everyone's happy. The artists get their cut. I have legal music. Everyone's good. And I think that's kind of where I think maybe we can draw from that somehow. I don't know how exactly, but I just feel like there's an element of too much friction that's happening with this whole NDIN process. Again, bearing in mind that I do need to look into that further, but yeah, it just seems like it doesn't help from an innovation standpoint.
Okay, so it's a little more hindering. I do like your analogy, by the way. That was interesting.
Thanks.
And so I, research is the cornerstone of innovation. What do you think the industry can do to work together with the current regulatory frameworks to kind of help fuel innovation when it comes to dietary supplement research?
Oh wow. Yeah, that's a big one. And I think from a research standpoint, researchers themselves need to have a good understanding of what the FDA and FTC expects. Like, what is their bar? And I think researchers should have a good idea of that. And the reason why is when they're doing the research and they're designing the studies, we want to make sure that the findings can meet FDA and FTC expectations. Otherwise, ultimately, what's the point of the research? Like, I mean, scientifically, there's value in there, but from a supplement brand standpoint, there isn't. I mean, if it doesn't meet FDA or FTC's expectations, you can't make that claim. You can't really speak to it. Or at least there's more compliance risk as a result if you were to utilize that claim. So ultimately, I think that there needs to be something where the researchers themselves can have easy access to information that can show them what the FDA and FTC expectations are. I think there's another element of, maybe we can conduct research with existing ingredients, but repurposed, right? We can look at new mechanisms of actions. We can look at new pathways. We can look at new or other physiological conditions and essentially repurpose ingredients that are already known to be safe, that has been used in the dietary supplement supply chain for many years. We're kind of taking a page out of the pharmaceutical world of repurposing active ingredients. Maybe we can do something similar in that vein versus trying to innovate for a brand new ingredient altogether. And then lastly, I think, even though I'm talking more of an ingredient standpoint, innovation doesn't have to be about the ingredients. We can look at packaging. We could look at, changes in dosage forms. We could look at just the user experience or convenience. I think innovation can take so many shapes and sizes from that aspect, not necessarily just ingredients per se in our world.
Right. I've seen a lot of shots lately. And of
Yep.
course, we know gummies have completely taken over, something we didn't see, maybe a decade ago. So certainly.
My goodness. Yeah. Every day there's an inquiry about gummies. Every day. Yeah, I hear you.
And so looking around, what opportunities do you see coming to market in, say, the next 5 years for innovation, would you say?
Yeah. So this is a really good question. I think about what, like, us as a society. And yeah, I think there are lifestyle themes that I think we are going to face if we aren't facing already, right? There's a generation that has only known life with an iPhone or a Samsung phone. And there are environmental factors that are going to be unique to the upcoming generation. So like we as in the collective, we are becoming a population that is more anxious. This idea of low testosterone in men is becoming a thing. Dropping fertility rates is becoming a thing. Lowered interaction between people with each other, that's becoming a thing. And I'm gonna throw this out too, like we have yet to see the full impact of COVID and the lockdowns and all these things.
Yeah.
And you know, when I look back at, you know, if I reverse and look at the last 15, 20 years, you know, which products did really, really well? Which ingredients did really well? Well, to me, it's not really an ingredient or claims thing. If we look at what has really exploded, it was this idea of plant-based. It was this idea of clean. It was this idea of all natural and keto and energy. So it was really a lifestyle thing. And so with that in mind, you know, it's not necessarily a specific ingredient or claim, but this lifestyle opportunity for brands to serve this consumer base of anxious people or those that are looking at increasing their testosterone. And obviously, I'm not, you know, to be clear, I'm not saying that we want to brand supplements to treat these issues or cure these issues or boost testosterone per se, but it's more like addressing this lifestyle habit and integrating this habit into those that experience these types of health issues. Either they're trying to manage these health issues, maybe they have a very unique nutritional needs because of these health issues. It just becomes like a part of their daily habits. It's similar to us that just decide to be gluten-free, not because we have celiacs, but just because it's more of a lifestyle choice. We're just more gluten aware, if you will. So I think there's an opportunity from that standpoint. And I think, you know, even with Ozempic, right? And this maybe there's like this drug and supplement synergy in the future that we have yet to crack. I think we're maybe Ozempic is the catalyst, and maybe we're gonna start see even more supplement brands or niches where they're there to be used in conjunction with pharmaceutical drugs, not necessarily to treat, you know, or replace drugs, but to be used in conjunction with them to a certain degree within the realm of compliance, of course, and within the realm of the dietary supplement requirements.
I'm already seeing a lot of GLP-1 companions. So whether that means filling in a nutrient
Exactly.
gap or maybe helping out with that decreased muscle, we're definitely seeing that.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it.
And so before I let you go, what's next for you? Do you have any, I don't know, new announcements or events or things that you're looking forward to?
Well, I mean, this industry is this things change so quickly, and there's so many things going on, which is exciting. That's a great thing. I think one of the things for us, you know, we talked about the challenges of finding manufacturers and for, you know, the challenges of just trying to get your foot in the door with startups. You know, one of the things that we're looking at is just establishing really strong relationships with very well-known manufacturers that appreciate and understand our standards, that the, you know, our testing standards, our protocols, so that it makes the whole contract manufacturer search much easier for these startup brands. So something that we're building upon right now. It's hard. It's difficult to find the good manufacturers, let alone those that are willing to work within our more compliant or stringent compliance standards. The other thing that we're working on is obviously just building up our YouTube channel and, you know, LinkedIn community, like just trying to foster that, build up more content. I think, you know, we'd love to be a leader in terms of a resource for entrepreneurs and established brands, and to obviously partner up with colleagues in the industry and, you know, be on a podcast like NutriCast podcast, of course, and to be in the conferences. And perhaps, you know, something we're looking at is directly engaging with the FDA in this endeavor. And then lastly, like, you know, we do have a few spots open right now to working with established brands left. We don't take on a lot of established brand clients typically. We like to keep that to a minimum, just so that we give the optimum service for them. You know, from a short-term standpoint, it's something we would love to plug in. But yeah, lots going on for sure.
All right, well, you have your work cut out for you, Brian.
Yeah, don't remind me.
Brian Hamm of Blue Ocean Regulatory, thank you so much for joining me here on the NutriCast to help us navigate pitfalls and explore innovation from a regulatory standpoint.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
If you like what you just heard, you could subscribe to the NutriCast wherever you get your podcast. You can also head to NutraIngredients-USA.com for even more Nutra-related content. Thank you for listening. I'm Danielle Masterson. As always, I'll catch you here on the NutriCast next week.